Hello and welcome to the FinTech Newscast. My name's John, and with me, you guessed it, as always, is Steve. How are you doing?
You can never get rid of me, John. I'm always here.
Yes. You are. We are like the COVID-19 of podcasts. You just can't shake us. A FinTech
The cockroach in the nuclear apocalypse of COVID-19. That's
podcast.
us.
FinTech. And we're lucky to have with us this week the CEO and founder of Incognia, Andre Faraz. Thanks for joining us.
Hey guys, nice to meet you.
Yeah, glad you're on with us. You're a behavioral biometrics company. Why don't you tell us what that is and what you guys do over at Incognia?
Cool, thanks. As most of us know, behavioral biometrics is a space that has been growing fast. Most companies in the space have been leveraging signals such as keystrokes and other signals like how you hold your phone and things like that to create a behavioral profile for authentication and fraud prevention purposes. We're doing a similar thing, but coming with a very different approach. We're actually leveraging location and motion sensors to create this behavioral fingerprint as well. So what we do is basically identify like the data from the sensors on the device, including Wi-Fi signals, Bluetooth signals, and others. And we create fingerprints for each location. This enables us to locate mobile devices with much higher accuracy than if we were using GPS, for example. And this enables them to create a behavioral profile for each device that is based on where this device goes, right? So it starts learning, for example, where this device live, for example, or work based on the patterns of visits. And this is unique to each person, right? So we're leveraging this signal to enable mobile apps, especially in the fintech space, to create a better onboarding experience as well as authentication and payments. So glad to be here. Thanks for the invitation, and excited about what we're going to talk about today.
Essentially, the way in which this world used to work is that, say I live in California, as we do now, and somebody with an IP address or somebody with a location in, say, Missouri is opening a bank account. That would potentially flag the bank and say, depending on what systems they have, this is potentially fraud. Let's investigate further. How does the Incognia solution differ from that and add another layer of sophistication, if you will, to that?
Yeah, there are two things. First one is that this happens at a much higher accuracy. So it's harder for fraudsters to spoof their location, right? So if a fraudster is using a proxy or a VPN, they could potentially spoof the location of the IP address. Or if that user is creating an account from a mobile app and leveraging GPS signals. GPS is also very easy to spoof, but when you add those other layers and sensors to the equation, it becomes way more complex, right? So the fraudster would need to understand the Wi-Fi and Bluetooth patterns inside of the places, would need to be able to also leverage the accelerometer and gyroscope and compass. So you simply have more data, and it becomes harder for the fraudster to create a fingerprint for each location. So that's the first, the ability to prevent location spoofing. And then the other thing is that this is a continuous authentication solution, right? So it builds trust over time. And because of that, it becomes more secure as the user and interacts more with that mobile application. So because of that, we're able to do some other things at a more granular level. For example, the user is opening a bank account through a mobile app and they're declaring an address. We're able to match that address to the device's behavior and see if that device actually lives in that location. Addresses, for example, are usually overlooked on the onboarding process. So most companies do a very good job at verifying document data, verifying like email addresses and things like that, but not really a very good job at identifying if the address, which is a pretty good link between the device and the real world identity of that person, if they match, right?
You're in a really interesting space for so much that's happening these days with the trend towards mobile banking and, of course, all the fraud going on, but also with the trend towards protecting privacy. How does that affect you guys when Apple is locking down a lot of the information that you can access? Does that affect what you're able to do, or you have to go through some extra steps to ensure any privacy concerns are addressed? Yeah. Hey, hey, Steve, that wasn't your wife you were with the other night. We can tell
from the microphone
what's happening. seriously, there's so many concerns about that. I wonder how you work with that.
Yeah, and location is a particularly sensitive topic, right? But actually, those trends in relation to privacy are very good for our business. And I'll explain you why. But before I do that, I just wanted to provide some more context of where we came from. So this company actually started as an academic project about 10 years ago. And at the time, we were doing research in things like IoT security, for example. And then because of that, we started thinking about the implications that like insecure IoT environment could have, especially for our privacy, because you're going to have sensors everywhere. You're not going to be able to like opt into any sensor that is around you, right? As we do with cookies today and on the web. So we started thinking, okay, how do we solve that problem? And the original idea 10 years ago was to create a digital identity that would be completely anonymous and would be able still to authenticate you to the IoT devices with very high security, right? And then the idea we've had at the time was, okay, we should leverage location signals for two reasons. First one is you would be able to identify the user's real-time location with very high accuracy and connect that user to the devices that are around. But secondly, you would also be able to leverage the location behavior, which is unique to each person, to create a behavior identity that is equivalent to a fingerprint of a person, but with an important difference, which is it will be dynamic. It would be always changing as the person moves. So from a security standpoint, it's interesting because it becomes more complex to impersonate someone else's identity. So we actually started the company trying to address the privacy issue in the long term. And basically now we're here working with mobile banking and mobile commerce applications, doing pretty much the same thing. So we start with that intention, right? And then when we get to what we're doing today and how we are dealing with privacy, one of the most important things is that for this technology to work, we don't really need to collect any direct personal identifier. So we don't need a name, a phone number, an email address, anything, right? So it's only about the device and the device's behavior, and we don't link that type of data. That's on the customer. They really need to know who's that person, but we don't, right? So that's the first thing. The second is that we do apply a lot of anonymization to that data, including, for example, once we are able to discover where that devices live, we anonymize that particular information because that's the type of information that could very easily identify the user, right? Same applies to your work address, right? So what we do is we apply anonymization to that data specifically. And even though we do provide a service that verifies the declared address from a user, the way we do it is using an encryption technique that receives the data in an encrypted format, compares the two encrypted data sets, and is still able to provide a response without even knowing the exact address that was provided. So this is just a few of the examples that of things that we have implemented into this. But then finally, and more importantly, this is an opt-in type of solution, right? So the user would download the app. The app is going to disclose to the user that it wants to access location for security purposes and fraud prevention purposes. And if the user says, yes, I want this service, I want to protect my account, then location starts being shared with our company, and we never share the raw location history with our customers. What we do is we transform the location data and the location patterns into a risk assessment. And we're going to say, this is a high risk transaction, this is a low risk transaction. So we're basically scoring each transaction based on that data. So what's good about that is that both Apple and Google have been restricting the use of location signals for mobile apps. But one of the very few areas that Google and Facebook and Apple, sorry, are saying that you're good to use location and it's a legitimate use of that type of information is exactly fraud prevention and security. So I think even the platforms are recognizing the importance of this type of signal and approving this type of application.
So you work with both fintechs and banks as well. What is, you know, this, I think the whole Achilles heel of this process is that user opt-in, right? When I was doing something similar, we found that the opt-in rate, it was quite low, even when we made it clear this is for fraud purposes. Are you seeing any trends in that moving maybe towards people being more willing to share their location data, like you do with, say, Google Maps? We basically found that customers were more willing to share their data with Google Maps than with their bank, right? What numbers are you seeing, and where is that trend going, do you think?
We're seeing very interesting things. Typically, when we start working with a customer, their opt-in rate tends not to be very high. It's usually around like 30 to 40%, which is good, but far from being optimal. And usually the way the opt-in is requested has two little problems. The first one is the message around that. So it's usually not very clear. It's very generic, like this app wants to use your location, you accept or not. Like if you don't explain very well to the user, that could be an issue. And the second thing is when that is requested. So if it is requested right away when the user just downloaded the app, it could sound a little bit weird. Or if it's hidden in a feature like, oh, I want to enable automatic like travel information to my bank so I don't get blocked. So the user needs to go through a path that is usually not the standard to get there. So those are the two issues that we typically see. And the way we have been addressing that is first, and this only happens once the customer is able to see the results that a solution like that is able to deliver. But once we are good with that, so the customer has tested the technology, saw that it really works very well, then we get into a phase which is first, we get into the customer's app and we define what is the best moment to request this information. If it's a new account, that is typically in the moment the user is entering the address information. Why is that the ideal moment? Simply because that's a moment in which the user recognizes that this signal is going to be used to verify that information. So it's simply more clear to the user. And then if the message is very clear as well, so we're using this to protect your account for security purposes, for fraud prevention purposes, it tends to bring those numbers to a different level. So we're typically seeing the fintech and banking industry, after going through that process, reaching more than 85% opt-in rate, which is pretty good.
That's incredible. That's much higher than what I saw when I was back in industry. On the flip side, I saw recently that the incidence of account takeovers or something like increased 280%, during the pandemic from October of last year to October of this year. What are you seeing in terms of the kind of fraud taking place now in the era of e-commerce and COVID and contactless payments?
Perfect. Yeah. Well, there was a lot of growth, right, in all of these areas. So definitely when when those volumes grow, it's easier for fraudsters to hide. So I think it was very like proportional to the growth in volumes. We are like seeing, we use an expression internally that we call like hair and fire. When the customer is currently being attacked, their numbers are changing rapidly and they need to react. That's usually the moment that we get involved and we integrate with them, just because the integration process of this is very simple. Like in less than an hour, a customer can set up the solution and get started. We are seeing a lot in regards to account takeovers. Technology like this definitely can spot that very quickly. So far, we're seeing a precision of 99.9997% in detecting account takeover fraud. Wow. Simply because like the location signals are so accurate that they're able to discriminate very, very quickly between a legitimate customer or fraudster. Overall, our customers are being able to fix that problem very quickly. The way this is happening is typically when their hair is on fire, when they're being attacked.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, security is such a cat and mouse game. You haven't seen any new tricks lately? I mean, I have to kind of grudgingly admire these criminals sometimes because they're so creative. They do all these tricks, these elaborate things to, just to get into someone's account that's not like a multimillionaire even.
Yeah.
Have you seen anything like that? Some kind of interesting stories?
Well, in general, I'm seeing two main things. The first one being simply like social engineering becoming more frequent. So there's a lot of data about us available on the web and the deep web. Fraudsters are using that data to call us as if they were like the bank. They're using social media. They're using whatever channel they have to convince that person that they're your bank, right? And that typically happens with either bad news, right? So your fake bank calls you asking if a big transaction happened. There's suspicion about that transaction. The fake bank actually thinks that was fraud. So this is the kind of thing that, like, if you receive a call like that, you definitely become worried, right? Oh my god, someone is trying to steal me. So because of that, it makes the person more vulnerable. And then once that person starts telling to that user, I just need to confirm some information about you. Is this your social security number? Is this your name? Is this, you know, and then the person starts trusting that person independently on the channel, right? And eventually that fraudster is going to ask for information that will be used later for an account takeover. So we're seeing a lot of that, more and more social engineering attacks becoming sophisticated and using a lot of channels. A lot of this happening also to attack mobile devices, especially because most of the fraud prevention engines and solutions were originally built for desktop and adapted to mobile. So they don't really leverage all the power that a mobile devices enable, like with those sensors that we use. It usually increases false positives as well, which then increases friction for consumers, but also exposes a lot of vulnerabilities in regards to fraud. Now, the second thing I should mention here are also the emulator attacks. Don't know if you've seen that, but I think Trusteer from IBM published a report late last year that a single fraudster was able to emulate and basically like create a device fingerprint that was the same of more than 16,000 bank accounts. And that fraudster was able to access all of those accounts. So it was a very large scale attack, much more sophisticated than just social engineering. Mm. So techniques like device fingerprinting are now more vulnerable to these type of things.
I assume this was some sort of state sponsor attack, right? Not an individual.
I'm not sure. Like, there's not enough information there, but it seems to be only for financial purposes. Like, that user was then able to access all of those accounts and move money. The emulators and the tools are becoming quite sophisticated. I saw one recently called Frida, for example, in which you can like manipulate any device and make it look like a device that is registered to an account. So and then fraudsters are also using malware to collect this type of information and like send the device fingerprints somewhere else and then reuse that information for that type of attack. So it's pretty scary. Like most of the techniques that work very well until like a year, 2 years ago are definitely not working. There's a third thing I think would be worth mentioning here also is that there is a lot in the phone intelligence space, right? So using data from the mobile network operators to verify users' identity and things like that. And as people, because of the pandemic, started spending more time at home, those consumers are spending more time connected to a Wi-Fi signal, in which this type of technique typically doesn't work as well. So that's another area that changed a little bit the landscape.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that, actually. With the lockdowns, makes your job a little bit easier, maybe. But when things open up and people start to move around a bit more, less predictably, is that going to change? You have to kind of up your game back again to like the pre-pandemic days. Is that going to change a lot for you?
Yeah, well, it's hard to tell, but I don't think it would change that much. Because, for example, we've seen and we operate in different countries, and we didn't see any significant difference in terms of performance when a certain city was, for example, in a lockdown. And then like a few weeks later, people were starting to move. And then like a few months later, people were moving like nothing was happening, right? And we didn't see much change in regards to the performance. I wouldn't say I'm very worried about that. I'm more worried about like a specific attack. So that's why we're always like leveraging more data and creating new signals.
You know, I'm always curious when a new company is coming in, especially something sensitive like this, how you convince those first few clients to go with a company that's just starting out. I mean, obviously, yeah. You have, I guess part of it is your excellent history and track record. How do you get those first few clients to trust you?
Yeah, well, we have to do two things, right? The first one is really identify the customers that are fast movers and are open to testing new technologies. Those are typically the startups, right? So this is where we got started, and most of the initial contacts were with smaller companies. And the second thing is also being very aggressive in terms of like how we bring this to market. So for example, we don't charge for a proof of concept. We let the customers use our solution for the first month for free, so they can see the results. So it's a very lightweight solution. It requires only 1 hour of development to set it up completely. So because of those things, we're approaching to market the market with two things. Like it won't hurt to test because you won't need to spend too much time integrating this, which is typically what happens with most fraud prevention solutions, right? You spend weeks or even months integrating something until you see the first results. So that's one thing. And then the other thing is just giving it for free, like test it, then we talk business later. I think that approach enabled us to grow faster in the first few months. This solution particularly was launched about 9 months ago. So it's very recent. And for example, here in the US, we're about to reach 30 million users being protected by this technology.
Oh, wow. Yeah, you're coming in at a really, really interesting time for a lot of reasons. How has it been during this time? I assume you've been hiring and maybe raising money. I assume that's very different than lately, than, well, before the pandemic anyway.
Yeah, well, we launched the product in June, right? So we were already in the middle of the pandemic. So it's pretty hard to compare it to before. Like we don't know, but in terms of like the company and the work dynamics, I think it's actually working pretty well. One of the main concerns I had was that I'm originally from Brazil, and I moved up here to the US last year to launch the product here. And at the time, we only had one person in the team, right? And because of that, we didn't have like a remote first kind of culture and work dynamics. So I was really concerned that I was get disconnected from our team in Brazil. We have a large engineering team with more than 70 people over there. So that was a concern. And then like weeks later, we had to adapt to work remotely and communicate primarily via calls like this. And it actually enhanced the way we work and the communication between the Brazil team and the US team. So yeah, it's been pretty nice. I think it's enabling us to learn faster and communicate in a much different pace. So I would say that I think it made the company more efficient.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, a lot of people at my work said they've been more productive since they haven't had to look at me at the office anymore. So I can see where you're coming from there.
Yeah, probably the same thing for me.
I'm sure that's not true.
That's probably not the case. Yeah. Yeah. So this is your second company, right? The first one you exited about 2 years ago, right?
Actually, last year in the middle of chaos.
Wow.
The other company was also in the location space, but we were actually in the marketing space. So we were helping mobile apps leverage location technology to engage their users in the right context, right? So if for example, you have a mobile payment solution and that person just entered a physical store that accepts that payment option, right? You could send a push notification with a coupon to that person and try to stimulate more conversions. So it was that kind of application that we did. We sold it to an e-commerce platform last year. And now I'm 100% focused on this fraud prevention and digital identity solution.
Awesome. I have to admit that although I do follow the fintech scene in Latin America somewhat closely, it's mostly been Mexico, Colombia, and then Nubank in Brazil. What's sort of the fintech landscape on the consumer side in Brazil? And what companies are really excited to see other than Brex, right, which has been the massive Brazilian-led success in the Bay Area?
Yeah. Well, the fintech space is amazing. I think, as you know, like Nubank is definitely the largest company over there, the most successful startup. And it's interesting how it got founded, right? So David, he was working at Sequoia Capital at the time. He was opening Sequoia's VC office in Brazil. And he realized like how bad the service from most of the traditional banks was, and he decided to create a bank, right? So he left Sequoia, he founded a company, and obviously he was able to raise capital from Sequoia, and yeah, it's a huge company. I think $25 billion market cap, probably one of the biggest fintechs in the world, and I think. That happening early, I think they founded a company probably around like 2012 or 13. It became a source of inspiration for a lot of other entrepreneurs, right? So there are many fintechs now in the Brazilian market growing super fast. I think there are now like probably 12 unicorns. Most of them are fintech companies. We didn't have any like unicorn in Brazil in like 20 18, I think. So it's growing super fast, the scene over there. And then there is one more thing that is pretty interesting, is that over the past 6 months, two important regulatory changes happened in Brazil. So the first one is called PIX, which stands for instant payments. It's a new like payment format that the central bank has created and enforced all of the financial services companies to adopt, which makes like payment work much, much more efficiently. And yeah, this created a new space for innovation. So that was one of the things. And then the second thing is that I think last month, there was a new regulation around open banking and forcing all the companies to like open up their APIs and all that stuff. So those two things are also changing the landscape very rapidly and creating space for innovation. So the startup scene over there is thriving, especially fintech.
Well, definitely keep up the good work, and we'll definitely have to have you back before the IPO.
Oh yeah, count me in. Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
Great, thanks. That's Andre Faraz, the founder and CEO of Incognia, keeping all of your accounts safe, apparently. Please hit subscribe to keep up with the latest in fintech news, and thank you for listening.